Hello, everyone. This is a re-recording of our last shiur in the series From People to Nation. The recording during the shiur got truncated due to a computer malfunction, so this is a re-recording. Hopefully it will be as accurate a repetition of what we said in the shiur as possible. There might be some differences, and I apologize for those in advance. In the previous shiur, we used the tshuva of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger regarding the what we once thought was a Moroccan convert and turned out to be an American Quaker convert in Yerushalayim who wanted to convert to Judaism in the 1800s. He went through the first part of the conversion process of circumcision and was waiting to complete the second, and the discussion arose as to what his Jewish status was. And according to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, he was in this kind of middle category of not being fully Jewish, not being fully halachically Jewish, but still not actually being the Gentile that he once was. And Rav Yaakov Ettlinger used that as a model to also explain the legal halachic status of the Avos, of the Shvatim, and essentially all of pre-Matan Torah Jewish people. Where they were not Gentiles, but were not fully Jewish yet either. According to the language of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said that the Avos and their families were be'etzem Jewish, meaning inherently their essence was Jewish, but they were not halachically Jewish yet. They did not have the legal status of Jews. So that was the previous shiur. In this shiur, what I want to speak about is sort of the flip side of that, which is, well, what actually happened at Matan Torah, right? This series is called From People to Nation, based on the language of Rav Soloveitchik and Kol Dodi Dofek, that Matan Torah was the sort of the paradigm shift in Jewish national identity that transformed us from an amalgamation of individuals into a nation, because the Torah serves as the nexus of our national Jewish identity. That's what Rav Soloveitchik said, that's what the Rogachover said, that's what Rav Shlomo Fischer said, so we discussed that in the introductory shiur. But that was more looking at sort of the broad communal picture of the role of mitzvos and the role of Torah. What I want to do this week is to look at it from a different angle and to focus more on the individual's relationship to Hashem vis-a-vis Torah and mitzvos. In other words, what did Matan Torah do in terms of transforming each individual? This, I believe, is one of the most important shiurim in the series. This shiur, as well as next shiur, are probably the two most important ones. What we're going to do this week is to examine that using the writings of both Rav Lichtenstein and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and to ultimately show how both of those, they use different phraseologies, but they say essentially the same idea, and how that can be traced back to the writings of the Ramban. But before we get to the actual Ramban, the broader topic of this idea of how to kind of approach this question of how did Matan Torah transform the Jewish people is to focus on a very interesting halachic question, and that is volunteerism in halacha. Now, by volunteerism, I do not mean doing chesed. Contrary to popular belief, chesed is actually an obligation, and not just for high school students that have chesed hours. Rather, we are always obligated to do kindness and to do chesed. What I mean by volunteerism is electing to do mitzvos that one is not obligated to do. In other words, what does Judaism think about volunteering to do something that you're not obligated to do? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it a neutral thing? At first glance, we would say, well, it's certainly a good thing. You're called a chassid. The Gemara says that a chassid is someone that goes above and beyond the law. So clearly, volunteering to do things that one is not obligated to do is certainly part of the ethos of Judaism. However, as we'll see, it's a little bit more nuanced than just simply saying that it's good. By way of introduction, there's an apocryphal quote. If you look at the beginning of the first page, below the title in the pictures of Rav Lichtenstein and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, there's an apocryphal quote that's attributed to Mother Teresa. She did not actually say it, but there's a quote. It says, I am a little pencil in the hand of a writing God who is sending a love letter to the world. Now, this is a very nice quote that talks about essentially being an agent of God, and certainly evokes the mentality, it certainly evokes the ethos of the term Merkava, of being a chariot. That, just like the Avos were a Merkava for furthering God's agenda, so too this quote that's attributed to Mother Teresa of being a pencil in the hand of God writing a love letter to the world, it certainly has similar vibes or connotations, that we are a medium through which God can bestow kindness to the rest of the world. However, the reason why I brought this quote is not just because it's nice or because it seems to echo the ideas of the Merkava, but rather I found this quote because I Googled quotes about volunteerism, and this was one of the first quotes, which is very interesting. I would not have necessarily said that this is a great example of volunteerism. Right? When we think of volunteerism, we think of electing to do something, of using our own volition, using our own free will, using our own ideas. We have an identity. There's a certain sentience that's required to volunteer to do something. You have to be able to think and want and use your own initiative. And the imagery of a pencil in the hand of God does none of those things. In fact, it's quite the opposite. A pencil has no free will. Pencil has no independent thought. It's simply a tool. And yet, if you Google it, this is a quote that's connected to volunteerism. Presumably because that's what they thought Mother Teresa said when she was speaking about volunteerism. But as we'll see, this quote actually has a lot to do with the way Judaism sees volunteerism as well. But before we get to the Torah's perspective on volunteerism, I think it would be useful to kind of look at the foil to Judaism's perspective on volunteerism. And that can be found in the writings of C.S. Lewis. If you turn to the second page of the source sheet, in source number 4, this is an excerpt of one of C.S. Lewis's most famous books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It was the earliest book that he wrote in the Chronicle of Narnia series. As I'm sure many of you know, either you read it as a kid, or you heard about it, or maybe you saw the movies. It's a Christian allegory. And just to provide a little bit of context about what we're going to read, there are four children that are transported into the world, this magical world of Narnia. One of the brothers essentially betrays the other siblings. And the villain in the story is this evil white witch. And she confronts them and says that according to the deep magic from the dawn of time of the world, that deep magic stipulates, is a law of nature, that all traitors belong to her. In other words, this boy is now her slave. She can do with him as she pleases. And the God, king, deity figure is a lion in this story. His name is Aslan. And Aslan volunteers to essentially take his place, under the witch's control, and he sacrifices himself for this boy. So the witch takes the lion, takes Aslan, brings him to an altar, which is called the stone table. It's described as being a huge altar-like stone table with very old, ancient, strange letterings around the border, the perimeter of the table. She ritually kills the lion, and she leaves. And then a few hours later, Aslan, the lion, comes back to life. He's resurrected, and the stone table cracks, and then the tide turns, and ultimately they are victorious, and the witch is defeated. So very, very clearly, the lion, Aslan, coming back to life is meant to symbolize Jesus and the crucifixion and the resurrection. But there's a couple of interesting points that are relevant for our discussion. So let's take a look at source number 4. So Aslan is explaining what happened to to the other siblings. He says, Though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. So once again, this is echoing the crucifixion and resurrection ideas that the Christians believe. But there's also something a little bit more about it, which is the abrogation of the deep magic by something much more fundamental that took place even before the world was created. Right? We have the deep magic, which says that traitors belong to this witch. And the deeper magic is you can have sacrifice, you can have a loving sacrifice which can undo that deep magic. And this deeper magic, as it were, was created even before the dawn of time. And what that's meant to symbolize is the abrogation of the Old Testament, or the Torah Chas V'Shalom. The Torah is often portrayed as being very draconian, very strict, that if you sin, you belong to the devil. That's what Christians believe. That's what happened. This boy was a traitor. He belonged to the white witch. And Aslan, or the Jesus figure, comes and sacrifices himself in his stead. And that triggers, so to speak, the more fundamental magic from before the dawn of time, something that is ostensibly even greater than the Torah, something more powerful than the Torah, which actually undoes the Torah. And death, or so to speak, the natural world, or the result of natural sin that is created by violating the Torah, that is wiped away. Additionally, the cracking of the stone table symbolizes also two further things. The first thing that it symbolizes, or it alludes to, is the Christian belief that when Jesus was crucified, the paroches, separating the Kodesh HaKadoshim from the rest of the Beis HaMikdash, was ripped in half. And that was meant to symbolize that the barrier between heaven and earth was shattered by the crucifixion. Now, you didn't need a Beis HaMikdash, you didn't need Kohanim, you didn't need all these laws and institutions in order to get close to God, that essentially the priestly caste and the Beis HaMikdash and the Torah were, so to speak, the gatekeepers too. Now, you didn't need any of that. Because of Jesus' sacrifice, all you needed to do was to essentially believe, love, and do good works. Parenthetically, Jewish tradition also has a different account of when the paroches was shattered, or when the paroches was ripped. The Gemara in Gittin says that we have a tradition that when Titus came and destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash, he took a sword or a knife and slashed the paroches, and blood dripped out. And he said that, oh, I've killed God, chas v'shalom. What that's meant to symbolize was the pain of the Shekhinah. Now, paradoxically, even though the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the paroches was ripped, symbolizing the barrier between heaven and earth being shattered. In other words, through exile, we also have a very close, profound connection with Hashem, because Hashem now is not, so to speak, resting in the Beis HaMikdash while the rest of us are outside, but rather, he's outside with us in exile. So in a certain sense, we're actually closer to Hashem in Golus than we are during the Beis HaMikdash. It's a very different type of relationship. Maybe when we get closer to Tisha B'Av, we can talk about it more. But that's just parenthetically, that we have a different tradition, but so to speak, the same symbolism. The second thing, though, that the cracking of the stone table is a metaphor for is the abrogation of the Old Testament. As I said, the stone table had ancient lettering around its perimeter. And when that was cracked, that was like, so to speak, the Luchos, or the Torah, being cracked, saying that now you do not need Torah to get close to God. You do not need Torah to get to heaven. Now all you need is essentially a connection to, or belief, or faith in the crucifixion and in Jesus. So that's what Christians believe. In other words, the barrier between heaven and earth was shattered through an act of sacrifice, a voluntary sacrifice, and that's all you need. We Jews believe quite the opposite. Just as a small point, if you go back up one source to source number 3, this is a Medrash Rabbah. So the Medrash Rabbah says, Amar Reb Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish said, Shnei alafim shana kadma ha-Torah lebriyasa shalolam, that the Torah preceded the creation of the world by 2,000 years. Now 2,000 years is not just a big number, but rather 2,000 years, for various reasons and from various sources, symbolizes a discrete unit of time measurement of an era, of a certain way of life, a certain modality of existence. It's an era. And so the Torah preceded the world by an entire era. So the Torah is not of this world, the Torah is essentially a product, the Torah is a creation that preceded the world and enabled the world to be created. So just straight off the bat, and I don't know if C.S. Lewis was aware of this Medrash Rabbah, but it's going against his metaphor, against his description. He described the Torah as the deep magic from the dawn of time, but there's something much more fundamental that goes, that transcends the Torah from before creation. But here the Medrash Rabbah is repudiating that belief, and it's saying that the Torah itself preceded creation by an entire era. Before the dawn of time, we had the Torah. And it's that Torah that allows, as we'll see, that facilitates the connection between heaven and earth. If we go back now to Source 1, we'll see another time, or the only time in history, where we believe that heaven and earth actually, where heaven and earth actually merged in a very profound way that never happened before and probably will not happen any other time. That is Matan Torah. If you look in source number one, this is a pasuk from Shmos. It says, "V'har Sinai Ashan Kulo," the entire mountain of Sinai was smoking. "Asher Yorad Alav Hashem Ba'esh," because Hashem had descended upon it in fire. Now, obviously, Hashem doesn't have a body, so what that means is, in a more abstract sense, but what the message is that Hashem, in some form, descended into this world to give the Jewish people the Torah. And if we look in source number two, this is from the liturgy of Rosh Hashanah, from Shofros in Musaf. It says this quite clearly, "Ata neglesa ba'anan kvodecha al am kadshecha ledaber imam." You were revealed in your cloud of glory to your holy people to speak to them. So once again, we have revelation, we have God descending, but it's to speak with them. It's for a constructive purpose. "Min hashamayim hishmatam kolcha," from heaven your voice was heard. "V'niglesa aleihem ba'arplei tohar," and you revealed yourself in a pure cloud. So once again, we have revelation, but it's because, or so that we can hear God's voice. "Gam ha'olam kulo chal mipanecha," the entire world trembled from your presence. "Ubrios gracious chardu mimecha," and the creations of the very creations of the world, things that existed from the dawn of time, trembled before you. "Malkeinu, our king, al har Sinai," why? "Velamed la'amcha Torah mitzvos," when you came, when you descended, when you revealed yourself to teach your nation Torah mitzvah. So we have things from the dawn of time literally trembling and shaking because God has descended, because heaven and earth has merged. Why? In order to teach Torah and mitzvahs. "Vatashmiim es hod kolcha," and you let them hear the majestic splendor of your voice. "V'dibros kadshecho milav osesh," and your holy words from flames of fire. So we see this idea that heaven and earth did merge. God descended, as it were, into this world, but it wasn't through the abrogation of laws, it wasn't through the abrogation of stricture and institution, but quite the opposite. It was in order to facilitate giving Torah and mitzvos, in giving laws and regulations and obligations. That was what facilitated and made that union between heaven and earth possible. If you look on the right, this is a painting by Chagall of describing Matan Torah, of Moshe and some divine figure joining hands together by holding the luchos. This is not just something that Chagall made up in his imagination. It's based on a Gemara in Sukkah, which very poetically describes how Hashem descended a little bit, Moshe ascended a little bit, and they met in this sort of mid-neutral zone, as it were, where the luchos touched each other's hands. In other words, the giving of the Torah, the symbolism of that Gemara and this painting and the liturgy of Shofros, all point to the repudiation of this Christian belief that religion and laws and strictures must be shattered in order to facilitate getting close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but rather quite the opposite, that the only way it's possible for heaven and earth to merge in order to make revelation, in order to make the union possible, is through obligations, through Torah and mitzvos. And that's really the question, and that's really what changed by Matan Torah when we got that. But the question is why? The question is, why is that necessary? Why is it that we believe that the only way it's possible to have this marriage, as it were, of heaven and earth, in order to shatter that barrier, in order for that paroches to be ripped apart, how is it that the only way that that's possible is through obligation and through Torah and mitzvahs? That's the sort of the big picture question I'd like to learn with you today. And we'll do that by analyzing the other question that I said, which is volunteerism in halacha, which is how halacha looks at volunteering to do mitzvahs that you're not obligated to do. Now, as the title of our series indicates, this is a series about the avos. So how does this all connect to the avos? Well, the last 2 weeks we've been discussing this Gemara in Yoma, which says that the avos kept all the mitzvos, and the last 2 weeks we've also talked about times where they ostensibly did not keep or should not have kept the mitzvos. We spoke about how Yaakov could marry 2 sisters. We spoke about how Avraham and all of his family could keep Shabbos, even though they weren't halachically Jewish. This week, I want to talk about a scenario where the avos, or where at least Avraham, did not keep a mitzvah voluntarily until much later in life, and that is the mitzvah of Bris Milah. Avraham did not do Bris Milah until Hashem told him to. And if we are correct, if we are actually correct that the avos kept all of the mitzvos on a voluntary basis, why then did Avraham wait until Hashem told him to do it? And so the Mizrahi, the 16th century commentary on Rashi, he gives an answer. And he says, because Avraham knew with Ruach HaKodesh that he would ultimately be commanded to do it. How the Mizrahi knows that, I do not know. But the Mizrahi says that Avraham must have known through Ruach HaKodesh that Hashem would ultimately command him to do it. Again, not sure how or why, but that's what he said. And therefore, Avraham waited. Why? Mizrahi, in source number 5, says, Va'az yiyeh mitzuveh ve'oseh, because then, when he would do it, after Hashem told him to, he would be fulfilling the mitzvah not on a voluntary basis, but as a mitzuveh ve'oseh, someone who is commanded to do a mitzvah and doesn't. And what the Mizrahi is referencing is a Gemara in Kiddushin, which is a very strange or counterintuitive Gemara. And the Gemara deals with our very question, which is better? Which do you get more reward for? Do you get more reward for volunteering to do something or for doing something because you're told to? I would have said that it's better to, you should get more reward for doing something that you're not obligated to do. You're going above and beyond the call of duty. That's when we give out medals. That's when we give out rewards. And yet, the Gemara in Kiddushin says no. Quite the opposite. It says, Umami she'eno mitzvah ve'oseh, someone who is not obligated to do a mitzvah and does it anyway on a voluntary basis gets rewarded. Let's be very clear. It's still a good thing. Volunteering to do a mitzvah is a good thing, and you get rewarded for it, according to the Gemara. But mitzvah ve'oseh, someone who's obligated to do it and does it, al achas kama ve'kama, gets even more reward. To Amar Rav Chanina, because Rav Chanina said, Gadol mitzvah ve'oseh mimi she'eno mitzvah ve'oseh. Greater is one who is obligated to perform a mitzvah and does it than one who isn't obligated and voluntarily performs it. So here we see the Gemara saying quite clearly that I wouldn't say that it's better, but you get more reward for doing something that you're obligated to do than for doing something on a voluntary basis. And that's why the Mizrahi says Avraham waited to do Bris Milah, because he felt it would be better that way. Now, the Gemara itself acknowledges that this is a very counterintuitive position. The Gemara continues and says that Rav Yosef said, I didn't think that at first. I was always working under the assumption that it's better to volunteer to do something, and he had certain positions based off of that. We'll go into that maybe another time. But Rav Yosef ultimately accepts Rav Chanina's position. And he says, you know, I didn't think it made sense, but this is what Rav Chanina said, and now I'm accepting that as the truth, and that's what we paskin like. We believe, based on this Gemara, that it is greater to do something that you're obligated to do than to volunteer to do something. And the question is why? The Gemara itself says that it's a counterintuitive idea, but the Gemara actually never gives an explanation. So the Rishonim give a multitude of answers. One position, like Tosfos, says that the Yetzirah is greater, right? We have a concept called the Fumtzara Agra, that you get more reward, that the greater the challenge, the more reward you get. And so the Yetzirah works extra hard to prevent you to from doing something, from discouraging you to do something that you're obligated to do than volunteering. We all like to do things that make us feel good. We all like to do things that are extra. It's always nice to have like a minhag or an extra custom that was passed down or that we, you know, came up with. But when it comes to doing a mitzvah, something that we're obligated to do that we're not super interested in, then somehow it's a lot harder for us to muster up the perseverance to go ahead and do it. So that's what Tosfos says, that we get more reward because the Yetzirah works extra hard. Another pshat is that since you're obligated to do it, you'll put in greater amounts of effort to make sure you do it properly. Tosfos also says that. But the Ritva gives a very interesting answer. The Ritva, in source number 7, in his commentary to this Gemara, he says, V'Rabbeinu HaGadolzal, our great teacher of blessed memory. Now, whenever the Ritva writes that, it means the Ramban. It means his sort of grand Rebbe. The Ritva's Rebbe was the Ra'ah, and the Ra'ah's Rebbe was the Ramban. So the Ritva brings an answer from the Ramban. He says, Shahamitzvas einan lahanas hakel yisbarach, that the mitzvahs are not for the benefit of God, ela lizchuseinu, but rather they're for our merit. Right? We say at right before a Kaddish, the end of the Gemara in Makos, that Hashem wanted to increase the reward of the Jewish people, and therefore he gave us a lot of Torah and mitzvos. So the Ramban, according to the Ritva, says that the purpose of the mitzvos is not to benefit God at all, rather it's to benefit us. Umishu mitzuve, and someone who's obligated to do something, kiyem gzeiras hamelech, has the added benefit of also fulfilling the commandment of the king. Ulefichach, and therefore, schar meruba yoser mizeh shelo kiyem mitzvas hamelech. And so therefore, you get more reward for doing something when you're obligated to, because you fulfilled the commandment of the king, more so than somebody that just volunteers to do it. Now, the Ritva clarifies and says that obviously somebody who volunteers to do a mitzvah gets rewarded, but you get more reward, and it's perhaps greater to do something when you're obligated to do it, because in addition to whatever good is accomplished through the mitzvah, right? Mitzvahs are good, so they do something. But in addition to that, you also have the added benefit or value of fulfilling the commandment of the king, of fulfilling the commandment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what the Ritva says. Now, if we would just take this Ritva or Ramban at face value, it would seem like a rather technical answer. So when you volunteer to do something, you have one good deed, and when you do something that you're obligated to, you have one plus one. You have an added benefit. So you get two mitzvah points, and so you get more reward than if you just have one mitzvah point. It could seem very technical, but Rav Lichtenstein, in his very classical, beautiful prose, quotes this opinion in two articles that he wrote, and so beautifully shows how it actually represents one of the most fundamental components of Yiddishkeit. So the first place that he wrote about this was in an Orthodox Forum book called Rabbinic and Lay Communal Authority. It's the second chapter. The chapter that Rav Lichtenstein wrote is called Communal Governance, Lay and Rabbinic, an Overview. And he writes, I'll just read it verbatim because it's so beautiful. He says, the concept of a mitzvah, our stance vis-a-vis the Rabbonu Shel Olam as commanded beings, as son and servants both, lies at the epicenter of Jewish existence. Mitzvos are the centerpiece of Judaism. Not only do we glorify servile fealty to divine orders, not only do we glorify doing mitzvahs, but following Chazal and in the face of intuited common morality, we revel in the contention that action in response to the halachic call is superior to the same act voluntarily undertaken, gadol hamitzuva v'osa. So Rav Lichtenstein says, contrary to common sense, we follow this Gemara in Kiddushin. And this presumably not or not only because, as some Rishonim held, like Tosfos, it assures a more conscientious implementation, but because over and above the practical result, meaning the inherent good of a mitzvah, the halachic charge renders the act intrinsically and qualitatively superior. Why? Inasmuch as it engages the agent in a dialogic encounter with his master. In other words, Rav Lichtenstein says, Kiyam Gzeiras HaMelech isn't just a mitzvah point, but rather, it's a relationship. It creates a two-way relationship with Hashem. If you look on the right, this is just an illustration of Buber's I-Thou relationship, where you have I and Thou, and then you sort of have a sacred space that connects the two. I don't think this is what Buber meant, but just kind of appropriating it for our purposes to illustrate Rav Lichtenstein's point. The point of Torah and Mitzvot is that sacred space to create that connection between the Kaddish Baruch Hu and us. That sacred space in between the I and the Thou is obligation. And the reason why it's obligation and not just volunteering, Rav Lichtenstein says, is because you need a dialogic encounter. It needs to be a two-way street. A relationship is really only a relationship when it goes both ways. If you volunteer to do something, that's a one-sided relationship. Rav Lichtenstein, in another article, in a book by his light, in the third chapter, he says this quite clearly. He acknowledges that volunteering to do something is still very good and serves an important function. He says, presumably, one who is eino mitzvah va'ose, one who is not commanded but nevertheless performs acts in accordance with his or her personal inclination, and therefore attains more self-fulfillment than one who is simply commanded to do this. Meaning, Rav Lichtenstein acknowledges that volunteering has a very important place in Judaism because there's more self-fulfillment in that. And yet, Chazal said, Gadol ha-mitzvah va'oseh, thus placing at the center or even the apex of our spiritual lives the sense of being called and commanded. This is what religious existence in general is about. The concept of mitzvah presupposes an encounter between someone who issues a command and someone who receives it. This is one sense of the term mitzvah. The act and the experience of God issuing the command and humanity absorbing it. So Rav Lichtenstein is saying that the reason why obligation is so important is because it creates a two-way relationship of a mitzvah and a mitzvah, of a commander and a commandee. When we do something in response to Hashem's call, that creates a two-way relationship. When we volunteer to do something, that's very nice and it's very important. But it's one way. It's just us. We're doing something for God, but God's not doing anything with us. When there's a mitzvah, then we're doing something with Hashem. And that creates a relationship, and that's what's so central in Yiddishkeit. And if you think about it that way, then there's something very special about Bris Mila. Right? It's not a coincidence that Bris Mila was the first commandment that was ever given to the nascent Jewish people, or the proto B'nai Yisrael, to Avraham. There's something very special or unique about Bris Mila. In source number 10, this is a Gemara in Menachos, it tells a story about David HaMelech entering the bathhouse. On your right is a picture of the bathhouse in Masada. David probably was not in Masada at the time. He was probably in Ir David, but looked probably something quite similar to this. It says, B'shoa shenichnas David l'beis ha-merchatz. When David HaMelech entered the beis ha-merchatz, v'ro atzmo omed arum, and he saw himself standing naked. Omar, he said, Oy lish emod arum b'lo mitzvah. Woe is to me, I'm not doing any mitzvahs now. I'm naked without mitzvahs. But once he remembered that he had his circumcision on his flesh, he calmed down. And the question that everybody asks is, I don't understand. The mitzvah of Mila was fulfilled when he had his bris when he was 8 days old. Much older than that now. He was a grown man. So what mitzvah does he have right now? And the answer that Rishonim and Achronim give is that the mitzvah of Mila is actually a multi-part mitzvah. The Ragachever actually thinks there are three elements of the mitzvah. I think the more conventional understanding is that there are two elements of it. One is the act of circumcision. The other is the state of being circumcised. So this position was first expressed most clearly by the Marach or Zarua, one of the German Rishonim, in the responsa. In source number 11, the Marach or Zarua says, Ikar mitzvasan, the essence and primary component of Bris Mila, eino ha'asiya, is not the act of circumcision, but rather, ela shehamila chasuma bibsaro, but rather the state of being that the circumcision is etched into the body as a perpetual sign. In Yiddish, the term is gemalt, of being circumcised. What we're saying here is that the mitzvah of Mila is not just an act. An act is something that we do. State of being is who we are. So the first commandment of having a relationship with Hashem was not just doing something, but it was changing who we are, that in a certain sense we became a mitzvah. The mitzvah was not the act, but the mitzvah was us being in a certain state. We became what's known as, in Lamda's terms, a cheftza shel mitzvah, an object that you do a mitzvah with. Humanity was able to create and transform themselves into an object of being a mitzvah. And that is what changed in earnest at Matan Torah. If we look in source number 12, this is a Medrash Tanchuma from Parshas Va'era. Medrash says, Afal pi shegozar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hashamayim Shamayim LaShem Va'aretz Nasan Livnei Adam. Even though Hashem decreed from the pasuk that we say in Hallel that the heavens are Hashem's and the land belongs to people, that ultimately changed. L'maha davar doma, what can this be compared to? L'melech shagazar b'nei romi lo yardu l'suryur b'nei surya lo ya'alu l'romi. So it can be compared to a king that decrees that the people in Rome can't descend to Surya or Syria, and the people that descended, that the people of Surya or Syria can't go up to Rome. So what does that mean? I don't know exactly if I'm 100% correct, but I think that this is the Medrash Tanchuma is using a mashal of contemporary geopolitics. So at the time that the Medrash Tanchuma was written, the Roman Empire was divided into two parts, Eastern and Western. So the Western part, or the primary one, was in Rome. The second part was in Byzantium, and from the Jewish perspective, that was Surya or Syria or Anatolia. And so, depending on who was ruling, depending on the politics, depending on security, sometimes that border between Eastern and Western Rome was rather porous. People could open borders, people could go back and forth, and sometimes it was closed. And so the Medrash says this is comparable to when those borders were closed. Kach, so too, kishebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Olamo, when God created his world. Gozar v'omar, he decreed, saying, Hashemayim, Shemayim, Lashem, V'aretz, Nasan, Livnei Adam. There are two separate realms. Heavens are mine, earth belongs to humanity, and never the twain shall meet. But, kishebikesh liten es HaTorah, when God wanted to give the Torah, Bitel es hagzeira harishona, he abrogated his first decree. That our magic from the dawn of time, of that separation of heaven and earth, that was shattered by something that happened 2,000 years before. The Torah, when God wanted to give that Torah to the people, he abrogated, he smashed his decree and smashed the boundary. He said, Hatachtonim ya'alu la'alyonim, those that are below can come up, ve'elyonim yardu l'tachtonim, and those that are above can come down, va'ani hamaschil, and I will be the one that starts, va'yerid Hashem al Har Sinai, as the pasuk says, Hashem descended to Har Sinai, ve'el Moshe omar ale el Hashem, and to Moshe Hashem said, ascend, you know, come up to me. In other words, Hashem said, I will be the one, and I am the only one that can break this decree. And the only way that this decree can be broken, that heaven and earth can merge, is if I initiate this process. If there's a relationship between me and Moshe, and that relationship is a commandment of come up so I can give the Torah. This is the paradigm shift that occurred at Matan Torah. The paradigm shift was that heaven and earth can merge, but it can only merge through a two-way relationship of mitzvos, of commander and commandee. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe builds on this medrash and connects it to Bris Milah. If you look in source number 13, this is an excerpt from the first volume of Sichos, of speeches that the Lubavitcher Rebbe gave, the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, when he, I forget exactly what year this is from, but I think it's from the late 50s or early 60s. This medrash has been used in Chabad a lot, but the Rebbe was really the one that kind of developed it into the final form, connecting it both to Kabbalistic and halachic concepts. And so the Lubavitch Rebbe said that the reason why Avraham refrained from circumcising himself was because of this paradigm shift. He says, before Matan Torah, the world was in a state of that injunction, of that gzeira, of that decree that heaven and earth can't meet. So what does that mean? Hainu, shelo yiyeh kol kesher ben gashmius l'ruchnius, that there can't be a connection between spirituality and physicality. It's just volunteering. Ve'ilu b'matan Torah, but by Matan Torah, nisbat l'hagzeira, that decree was abrogated. Ve'nitna ha'efsharis l'chibur hagashmius v'haruchnius. And what was then possible was to merge the two, was to marry Gashmius and Ruchnius. Matan Torah Chidesh, Matan Torah established Shebikiyam HaMitzvos, that through the fulfillment of mitzvos, Be'emtzos, Chefetz Gashmi, with physical mundane objects, Na'aseh HaGashmi Atzmo L'Dover Kadosh, that the objects themselves are transformed into something holy. Then he continues, HaMitzvos Shekimu HaAvos, the mitzvos that the Avos fulfilled, Af Shenasu BeEmtzos Chafetzim Gashmiim, even though they also use physical objects, Lo Haisalehem Kol Hashpol HaGashmi Atzmo, it couldn't actually have any lasting impact on the physical objects. V'hu Nishar B'chumriyuso K'mikodem, and it remained in its same physical status as it was before. But after Matan Torah, Oses HaGashmi Atzmo L'Kadosh, that the object itself is endowed with spirituality. We don't, when we have a talis or tefillin or a lulav or a sefer Torah in varying degrees, we treat them with respect because there is inherent kedusha to them. V'lachein lo haya behem hayecholes lahachter kedusha begashmi. But because the avos were only volunteering to do these things, they couldn't imbue them with sanctity like we do. But there was one exception. Harei Maase Avos Simen V'Nesinas Koach Labanim, that as a sign and empowerment for their descendants, Nitna LaAvos Mitzvah Achas, the Avos were given one commandment, B'Dugmas HaMitzvos Shalachar Matan Torah, modeled after what would happen after Matan Torah, V'Hi Mitzvah Smila. And that is the Mitzvah of Bris Milah. HaHofeches Es HaGashmi, that transforms the physical entity, L'Kadosh, to something holy, something whose entire essence becomes holy. The mitzvah is not the act of circumcision per se. It's part of it. It's necessary. But the ikar mitzvah, according to the Marach or Zeruah, is the state of being gemalt, of being circumcised, of transforming oneself into a mitzvah. V'lachein himtin Avraham. And therefore Avraham waited. And so, what we see here is that the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Lichtenstein are really saying what I think to be the same idea, just two sides of the same coin. Rav Lichtenstein takes a much more, what I would say, the much more lumdish and philosophical approach of saying that it's more important or it's better or it's qualitatively greater to do mitzvahs when you're obligated to because you create this relationship with Hashem. And that's why we say Gadol Mitzuvah Ve'Oseh. Lubavitcher Rebbe takes a much more Kabbalistic way of looking at it and saying that it's the way that we're able to break that barrier between heaven and earth to imbue physicality with spirituality, which we can't do by merely volunteering. But you could say that those are just two separate rationales. One's a more rational, legalistic one, or more philosophical one, and the other one's a more Kabbalistic one. But as we'll see, the Ramban himself actually uses and incorporates both of them. In source 14, we have a sefer called Emuna Ubitachon. We said at the very beginning, of this year when we brought the Ritva's explanation for why Gadol Mitzvah V'Oseh is greater, we said that the Ritva is quoting the Ramban. He says, V'Rabbeinu HaGadol. The Ramban in his commentary to that Gemara in Kedushan doesn't actually say anything. So we don't actually have on record where the Ramban says this idea. However, there is this sefer known as Emuna Ubitachon. It can be found in the Masada Rav Kook books of Kisvei HaRamban. These were edited by Rav Chaim Shevel and are a collection of works that are, we know, are either written or we think are written by the Ramban. One of these books is Emuna Ubitachon. We're not exactly sure who wrote it. It's a bit of a discussion. It's attributed to the Ramban. It's very clear that it comes from the Ramban's orbit, that it was it has many ideas that are shared by Rambans in other places. Stylistically, it's similar to the Ramban. Rav Chaim Shevel's position is that it wasn't written by the Ramban, because just writing-wise, it's a little bit different, but he believes that it was written by a Talmud who heard these ideas from the Ramban himself, and he transcribed them. He bases that off for various reasons. If you look in the introduction to Emunah Bitachon, he kind of explains his rationale. But what Rav Chaim Shevel believes is that the Ramban gave these ideas in Emunah Bitachon as sort of shiurim in his yeshiva, and his Talmidim wrote it down. So this is either, you know, either a firsthand or a second or you know, transcript of what the Ramban said. It's a little bit difficult to actually say what the main theme of Emunah Bitachon is. It's a little disjointed, which is part of the reason why Rav Shevel thinks that it was a collection of shiurim. But it's largely organized around the Avos, Parshas Vayishlach, a lot of ideas that are related to that, and one of them is this idea of what happened at Har Sinai and its relationship to the people beforehand. So if we look in source number 14, the Ramban says, Kodem Ma'amad Har Sinai, before Har Sinai, Hayu Kol Hamaros, all of the visions of Hashem, all of prophecy, Mis Oberos Me'atzman Milamala, had to happen by God just, you know, being nice and giving it to us as a gift. Because we did not have the power at that time to ascend to heaven. It was only just, you know, if Hashem decided to grace us with something, could we withstand it? Because the people at that time only had seven mitzvos. And because of that, they weren't able to ascend to heaven. Ad Sheba Avraham, until Avraham came, v'netztava al hamila, and was commanded by Bris Mila. V'afal pishakim Avraham avinu kol ha-Torah, and even though Avraham kept the entire Torah, mikomakom gadol ha-mitzuvah va'oseh mimish einu mitzuvah va'oseh, it's better and greater to fulfill something when you're obligated to. V'al tachshov, and don't think, the Ramban says, ki ma'aloso shel Avraham avinu ha-isa gadola kol kach lifnei ha-makom mitzad shakim kol ha-Torah. Don't think that the greatness of Avraham is because he fulfilled the mitzvos of the Torah, because if that would be, the Ramban says, then our Gemara in Kedushin would be wrong. For in that case, someone who fulfills something, even though they are not commanded, should be greater than someone who is. But the reason why Avraham was beloved before Hashem, because he withstood the 10 tests. Next week, I hope to go into a little bit more as to, you know, what the significance of the 10 tests were, and, you know, not go into the actual tests themselves, but, you know, okay, what's so special about these 10 tests? But beyond that, what the Ramban is saying is that the reason why Avraham was so beloved and why God chose Avraham was not because he did mitzvos on a volunteer basis, but rather because Hashem tested him and he listened. Hashem told him, shecht your son, or bring Yitzchak up as a sacrifice, and Avraham was prepared to do that. Hashem said, lech lecha, and Avraham went. Hashem said, send Yishmael away, listen to Sarah, and he did. Some tests Hashem didn't say anything explicitly, but Avraham always endeavored to fulfill the obligation of Hashem. And that is why Avraham was chosen. Not because of mitzvos. Because the Ramban says that was a volunteer. That was volunteerism. And because they were volunteerism, we could not ascend to heaven. What really clinched the deal of what made the Avos special was the relationship that they had, like Rav Lichtenstein said, of being tested by God and showing their loyalty to God by listening to him. That dialogic relationship, when without mitzvos, except for Bris Milah, the proto-mitzvah was nisayon, was a test. It was Hashem saying, I'm going to do something with you and you're going to respond to me. It's that dialogic encounter of tester and testy in this context, instead of commander and commandee, but of somebody who tests and somebody being tested, that created that two-way relationship that made the Avos special and began the process of being able to ascend to heaven. So from this Ramban in Emunah Bitachon, I think it's very clear that Rav Lichtenstein and the Lubavitcher Rebbe are really saying two sides of the same coin. That the paradigm shift that occurred at Matan Torah was that the barrier between heaven and earth was shattered. It allowed physicality and spirituality to merge. It allowed people to imbue physical objects with spirituality, to bring God down into this world and not just have him hovering above us, and not just have Kedusha hovering above us. So volunteering to do a mitzvah might be wonderful, and it might be nice, and it might be important, as Rav Lichtenstein said. We get rewarded, and it helps our own self-expression. But it does not create a two-way relationship. And that two-way relationship is the only way to bring down Kedusha into this world. And we never actually said why explicitly. We alluded to it. Hashem has to be the one that starts. Hashem has to be the one that is the maschil, as the Medrash Tanchuma said. But we never really explained why. So if you look in source number 14, in number 15, the Shem Yishmuel, he quotes an idea from his father, the Avnei Nezer, who was both a massive Talmud Chacham and Posek, as well as the first Sach HaShavah Rebbe. And he gives a reason for Godol Mitzvah V'Oseh. Again, I think it's kind of the same thing, but he says it in a very, very different way. He says, "Hatam de gadol mitzvah va'osem imisha eno mitzvah va'osal pi divrei kadsho shel avi mori." My father explained the reason why gadol mitzvah va'osem shemasha basar v'dam pol b'mitzvosav kol kach hu mishum shehu shliach Hashem yisbarach hu shlucho shel adam kimoso v'harei hu ki'ilu Hashem yisbarach ba'atzmo hu oseh ha-mitzvah. The Avnei Nezer drew a parallel between mitzvah va'oseh to shlichus. Shlichus is a halachic concept called agency. We have a concept in halacha called shlucho shel adam kemoso, that the agent of somebody is like the person that is sending, like the mishaleach. Classic example is if a man wants to marry a woman, if Reuven wants to marry Sarah, they don't live in the same place and he can't go there, so he sends a shliach, he sends Shimon as his messenger. He gives Shimon a ring, and he tells Shimon, please go be Mekadesh Sarah, and so we can be married. So Reuven goes to Sarah, and he gives her the ring. And the question is, who's married, Reuven or Shimon? The answer is obviously Reuven's married. Why? Shimon was the one that did the Kedusha, and Shimon said, Hareat Mekudeshes. So why isn't Shimon married? The answer is quite obviously because Shimon is a shliach of Reuven. Shimon is an extension of Reuven. And so what the Avnei Nezer says is that shlichus is not just a technical, legalistic concept, but rather it's something much more fundamental. You become an extension of the other person. And the same thing is true, he says, by mitzvos. When we do mitzvos voluntarily, we're the ones that are doing it. And we're finite, limited human beings. So it's good for us. It's good for our self-expression. It's important for us. It's necessary, and we get rewarded for it. But it's limited in its cosmological impact. We can't bring down Kedusha. We're finite, mortal human beings. How can we break that barrier between heaven and earth? How can we draw down Kedusha? The answer is we can't. The only way we can do that is by being mitzvah va'osa, by being commanded, because now we're not the ones that are doing it. It's God that's doing it. We are acting as agents of Hashem, and we are essentially an extension of God. And so now we're not doing the mitzvah. God is doing the mitzvah. God is imbuing the physical object with spirituality. God is bringing sanctity into this world. In other words, like Mother Teresa apocryphally said, we are the pen in God's hand. We are a merkava. We are a chariot. So yeah, we're a thinking pen. We're a thinking chariot. But at the same time, the real saliency of our actions is that we are agents of Hashem. We are facilitating God doing things. If you look at the right, this is a word cloud of the law of agency. I'll just read a few of them. Relationship, actual, legal, contract, interest, personal, virtue, vicarious, partner, partnership, principal, brokerage. All of those terms are words that describe what we've been talking about. Things that Rav Lichtenstein spoke about, things that the Lubavitcher Rebbe spoke about, things that the Shem Yishmuel spoke about, things that the Marach or Zeruah spoke about. All of these words reflect elements or different aspects of shlichus, of agency. So what changed by Matan Torah was that we became agents of God. And when we became agents of God, that allowed and facilitated HaKadosh Baruch Hu coming down into this world, and it facilitated Kedusha coming down into this world. If you look at the bottom of the page, this is a famous quote of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, which is based off of various midrashim, including the Zohar, which is Tachlis Brias Olam Haza, the purpose of the entire creation, Hu Shenasa HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lios Lo Dira B'Tachtonim, is that God desired have a dwelling place in this world. And in order to have a dwelling place in this world, in order to merge physicality and spirituality, you need to have a relationship. And it can't be a one-sided relationship. It needs to be a two-way street of mitzvah and mitzvah, of commander and commandee. And once you have that two-way relationship, then God can be brought down. Then God can come down and shatter that ceiling between heaven and earth. So that's what changed by Matan Torah. That's what made us a nation. We became organized around the ability to have a two-way relationship with God and to imbue the physical world with spirituality. In other words, to create an entire society that's saturated with sanctity. That's what Rav Shlomo Fischer said, that all of Klal Yisrael, of the most simple people to the most sophisticated people, all occupy a space in the Jewish enterprise. And Judaism encompasses not only just rituals, but it encompasses every facet of society, because God wanted that. That was how God designed it. He designed it as a covenant, as a two-way street, in order to bring sanctity down into this world and to create a holistic society based on these principles. That's the end of this year for this time. Next week, what I hope to do with you, I said that next week is probably the second most important shiur. The next thing that I want to do with you is to go back to that line in the Ramban, that the reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu loved the Avos so much was because they listened to his tests. So at this point, we just said what that meant is that it's sort of like a proto-mitzvah. It's the way that it created a two-way relationship to Hashem. Of the one that is testing and the one that is doing the test. It shows a display of loyalty. That still, though, doesn't completely answer then, you know, why we still look up to the Avos. Obviously, they were great people and they were important, but that's before Matan Torah. There was such a paradigm shift. So what happened back then during those tests that impacts and still has ramifications for us, as Rav Aaron Cutler said 2 weeks ago when he spoke about how the Avos are so special and we have to treat them with reverence in Tanakh, when we study Tanakh. They're great people, but he said that if they weren't who they were, if they hadn't passed all those tests, then we would look different. Our national identity and character would look different if they hadn't passed those tests and God hadn't chosen them. So next week, what I hope to do with you, what I hope to learn with you, is a little bit more about what the significance of that is. Have a wonderful week.